Thank you, Your Honor. Brian Matisse with the Burke Simpson Law Firm, attorney registration number 33755. On behalf of the petitioner, Landmark Towers Association, I intend to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I hope that I can stop at that time. Your Honors, this case involves the organization of the Marin Metropolitan District, and I'm going to focus my argument on the jurisdictional question of specifically whether the trial court in this case had jurisdiction to set aside its own order if the order was procured through fraud in the court or through an intentional violation of due process. I think that's the crux of this issue here. Before I go into the legal argument, I want to just highlight a couple of important facts that underpin the due process violation, because the organization of Marin Metropolitan District is very unique in this case. First of all, the alleged purpose of the Marin District was to put in infrastructure, streets, water, sewers, landscaping, on the Marin property, which was a vacant piece of land south of Berry Avenue. But yet the district was, its tax base was primarily going to consist of the Landmark, a different, completely different subdivision to the north, different character, different infrastructure. The Landmark infrastructure had already been paid for, and the Landmark infrastructure had substantially all been installed at that time. So therefore, what it's really about is you're taxing one subdivision, high-rise condominiums, to put in infrastructure for a completely different subdivision. Second of all, at the time Marin was organized,
is there anything in the statute that prohibits that?
There's nothing, Your Honor, but there is a requirement of elections. And that's why this is important. Mm-hmm. There is also a case that I want to cite. It's in the briefs. It's a City and County of Denver versus Greenspoon. It's an older case. But it nonetheless says that when someone's property is taken and there's no benefits to it, when basically they are put into a special district, that was a district that preceded the current version of the Special District Act, it's a violation of due process to do that without giving that person notice. And that's because there's no benefits to the person. They're just simply having their property taken, taxes imposed on it, a lien imposed on it. The second unique point, Your Honors, is that the time Marin was organized, unlike a typical dirt district where you're starting from scratch, there were already 130 units at the Landmark under binding contract. Binding contract that was supported by earnest money, and the contracts obligated these purchasers to close and obligated them to pay prorated taxes on closing. That's different from your typical district where you're starting with no contracts in place, no purchasers that have binding contracts. Third, despite the existence of these 130 purchase contracts, the organizers went to great lengths, as Judge Pratt indicated in his order, they went to great lengths to avoid giving notice to the purchasers and they were creating the district. They actively misled the City Council of Greenwood Village by telling them, the City Council, that yes, we've given these people notice and we're all in favor of it. They actively misled the district court in this case by saying we are the only individuals who have contracts to purchase. They actively misled the court into thinking that notice was given.
In regard to the notice thing, I know you have lots of other, you know, items that come up, but I thought the statute required notice by letter to property owners as listed on assessor's records. Now these folks, these 100-odd condominium people who had purchase contracts, were no way listed on the assessor's records.
That's correct. In fact, no one, Your Honor, was listed on the assessor's records, not even the organizers were. That is one way of verifying that notice is given to everyone. But in this case, the organizers knew of these 130 purchasers. They had contracts. They knew that they had purchase contracts. So they knew, even without going to the assessor, that these people had binding contracts and were going to pay the taxes on the property. And therefore, they were eligible electors.
But let's just stick with Judge Rhodes' question.
Yes.
32.204 sets forth the requirements for a public hearing on the service plan.
Yes.
As I read the statute, that provision addresses a service plan submitted for approval to a board of county commissioners. And that's not what we're dealing with here, is it?
Your Honor, there's parallel requirements between the board of county commissioners hearing on the service plan.
Show me where that's in the statute, because as I read the statute, 32.1204.5, which does say approval by a municipality, doesn't expressly incorporate 32.1204 requiring procedures and notice. It does incorporate 202, it does incorporate 203, but it doesn't appear to incorporate 204. Nonetheless, I take it's your position, perhaps not theirs, that the notice requirements of 204 govern in this case, correct?
It's 32, the combination of both of them govern this case.
Okay, 32.1204.5 does not incorporate 31.204 expressly.
I understand. And I point out also to Mr. Dykstra's testimony, which is cited in the record. He was the expert by Marin. And Mr. Dykstra says that yes, notice is required.
All right. The notice requirement of 204 is public notice by publication, if I'm not mistaken. No, notice by the county commissioners to the petitioners. Well, that's not an issue here, take it, right? You're not objecting to
no.
The petition comes. And then it says there has to be publication, the date, time, location, and purpose of the hearing. Greenwood City, Greenwood Village published it, did they not?
That's correct.
So that notice requirement was met.
That's correct.
The next notice requirement is notice to property owners who are on the records. You can see none of these people are on the records.
Well, they weren't on the assessor's records, but they were, nonetheless, the individuals that were organized in the district knew of them, and they should have given them notice.
But the statute does require them, does it?
To my knowledge, there's nothing that says that they have to be given notice in that case, but Mr. Dykstra's testimony, which is their own expert witness, he stated that the property owners have to be given notice. And to the extent these people had contracts, and they were the ones that were going to pay taxes, they had to be given notice. Greenwood Village also required that notice be given to all the people that were property owners, regardless of whether or not they were on the records or not.
The minutes of the Greenwood Village City Council reflect that the notice provisions were complied with. That was the opinion of the city attorney.
The city attorney was, there's also questions were asked. Let me clarify. The notice requirements were complied with to the extent of holding the Greenwood Village City Council meeting. That's different from those requirements for the purpose of organizing the district. Your Honor, in any event, these issues here are an issue for the court, the trial court to consider. Judge Pratt had the ability to consider these. He just said that at this point, he didn't think he had jurisdiction to even go there.
Okay, but the notice requirements that are set forth in the statutes are matters of law that we can also consider, can we not? We can decide whether these notice requirements were met.
You can decide that, Your Honor, only if you're trying to find alternative grounds of affirming. Judge Pratt's ruling in this case was that I don't have jurisdiction to consider whether due process was met.
Okay.
I'll point out one more thing, Your Honor. The City of Greenwood Village was affirmatively misled because they were told and they asked repeatedly, were these people notified? And the representations of Mr. Police, of Mr. Davidson, and Mr. Conkro, the attorney, all stated that yes, we gave these people notice, and they were all in favor of this. That's a misrepresentation which was a prerequisite to City of Greenwood approval. The City Council requested that information and were misled on it. And therefore, to the extent they required more notice, they shouldn't have been
used. Mr. Matisse, I guess my question is a little more basic. Are we dealing with issues of fact here? You're making the assertion that various people were misled. But the court made no findings that people were misled or not. What I hear you saying to Judge Richman is that these are issues of fact that you need to send it back for trial on because the court did have jurisdiction and it should have addressed these because they were due process.
That's correct. And I'll point out, Judge Casewell, the court, in our brief, we take the position the court had jurisdiction to consider two things. Number one, was there a due process violation? And that's consistent with the In Re CLS case, which says that yes, they do have jurisdiction to consider that. It's also not inconsistent with the Burns versus District Court case, which says the trial court can look at least to whether there was due process satisfied when they're dealing with these kinds of statutes.
Didn't Burns say there's a limited exception if we decide that the time allowed is just way too short, that they were looking at 30 days there and that wasn't way too short?
In the Burns case, though the person had notice, the person who was objecting had notice of the entire set of proceedings, that person, Burns, just waited too long to file. That's different here because there was, just like in the CLS case, there was an active intent to disenfranchise these people and prevent them from appearing at both the Greenwood Village City Council hearings as well as at the other hearings. The second thing that's important is the court also has jurisdiction to consider whether there was a fraud perpetrated on the court. And the case law is both CLS case and CLS says that the court has jurisdiction to consider that. So if your honors find that Judge Pratt had the jurisdiction to at least initially consider whether or not there were a due process violation, as he found, he found that it was, they were void as a matter of law because the prerequisites weren't met, or alternatively, that there was a fraud on the court, and Judge Pratt indicates in his order that, that there were 24 different cases of attempted fraud on both the City of Greenwood Village and the court that, that, that he could identify, but he felt he couldn't do anything about. Judge Pratt, as the finder of fact and the initial determiner of the application of law of that fact, should remand it back to him for those determinations.
Counsel, we're going to give you a little more time, so if you want to argue more issues, take another, I want you 5 minutes, really the other side 5 minutes.
As understand.
Well, that's okay.
Understand.
Okay, go right ahead.
The other point I want to point out with Judge Pratt's ruling regarding the, is he made a finding that for the fraud of the court, he could not consider that because of CRCP Rule 60B limiting him to a six-month time bar on that. That was a misread of the six-month time exception in Rule 60B. Rule 60B has two provisions. The rule does not limit the power of the court to entertain independent action, number one, or secondly, to set aside the judgment for fraud upon the court. Judge Pratt conflated those two and said that because this is not an independent action, you can't set it aside for fraud on the court.
I'm trying to understand what we should do with Judge Pratt's whole discussion of the requirements of Rule 60B and, you know, and all this fraud went on, blah, 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 when he's already said, under this statute, I don't have jurisdiction to talk about this. He says on page 4, I'm required to deny the motion on this basis alone. But now I'm going to go on and talk about void judgment and fraud. I mean, it's, I don't have jurisdiction, but I still want to talk for a while.
That's correct. It's dicta, Your Honor.
Okay.
You do not deny it's dicta. And that's why it's appropriate, we believe, for the court to decide that threshold issue. Whether Judge Pratt had the limited jurisdiction to consider whether the time bar prevented him, as a matter of jurisdiction, to consider whether due process was violated, or alternatively, to consider whether there was fraud in the court.
The time bar in this case is exactly the same statute that was found to bar the case in Burns, is it not?
It's same language, but it's a different statute because the Special District Act
was repealed and reenacted.
Correct.
So the reenacted language is almost identical. It's like word for word.
That's correct.
Like one word.
That's correct. And Burns, Your Honor, allowed the court to look into whether or not due process was satisfied.
Do you think, that's my question, do you think Burns, when it says it's, we're going to look at whether the period is so unreasonably short, it was considering whether due process was met. That's what it was doing, wasn't it?
That's correct.
And I mean,
as applied to this case, Your Honor.
I don't see it saying that. Well, it did say, in this case, okay, in the case of Barr, the 30-day limitation is not unreasonably short. And you're saying this case, the only difference between this case, Landmark, and Burns, is that you claim in Burns, the petitioner had notice of the formation of the district?
That's correct. Burns, they said there was one in the court's findings of fact. Burns, there was active publicity about the formation of this district, and in fact, this individual participated in the process. In our case, there was active intentional acts by the developer, by the organizers, to prevent these people from finding out about it.
Well, there was publication of the hearings. There was publication of the district court's proceedings.
Publication alone is not sufficient. Mr. Dykstra's testimony in the record says publication is not sufficient.
But Mr. Dykstra's opinion is on a legal issue, whether the notice under the statute was adequate. The statutory requirements were met. You can see that, don't you?
But no, Your Honor, respectfully, they were not met, because the intent of the statute is that the purchasers of property, the people who are under contract or pay taxes, should have the opportunity to vote on it.
Okay, that's a different issue. That's an issue whether the election was proper. I'm talking about first the hearing before the Greenwood City Council.
The people would notice.
Yes, but the statutory language is different. In one case, it says they have to be a record. The other, it says they have to be taxable property owners, I believe is the language. You're claiming that the people that own condominiums were under contract to pay taxes, correct? And
that's
if
correct.
We decide that's true, they should have been included in the 30% count. And if they weren't, they didn't have to be included in the 30% count. it all depends on what those contracts mean, or the effect of those contracts.
And the contracts, as you know, Your Honor, the contracts both provide that neither party, at the time they were entered into, had any interest other than a contractual interest.
No, there are no owners. There's no question. There were no owners.
There's no title
owners. No title owners. The contracts that the condominium unit owners had were not, did not necessarily have to close. Isn't that correct? Judge Rafferty found, in that preliminary injunction proceeding, that they were not owners under the statute because they were not obligated to close the contracts. And there were numerous ways they were not obligated to close. Why is it any different for us to make that determination?
Well, Judge Pratt actually found the opposite. After, remember, Judge Rafferty's was a preliminary injunction hearing before there was discovery. The key point is if you look to paragraphs 12 and 14, paragraph 12 of the contract says they have an obligation to close. Paragraph 14 says they have an obligation to pay prorated taxes on closing.
At closing.
If they don't, they forfeit the earnest money.
But if there's no closing, they have no obligation.
Similarly, the individuals who were the organizers had no obligation whatsoever to pay taxes. They only had an option contract. They had a sham contract because they agreed that they would never require each other to pay taxes. And they also had a provision, paragraph 12, in their contract that said, in the event you don't pay taxes, you can't enforce it because you can't have sue for performance and you can't sue for damages. So there's no legal obligation, as Judge Pratt found. Indicted. Now, at this point, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Will the clerk put 20 minutes on the appellee's time? Sir, you have 20 minutes to make your argument. I mean, a total of 20.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Neil Marney. I'm counsel for Colorado Bond Shares, one of the interveners in this action. Sitting at the council table is John McNamara, who's counsel for both Colorado Bond Shares and the Marin Metropolitan District. I'll be arguing on behalf of both appellees. Your Honors, this is a case where you've got a group of wealthy, sophisticated individuals who, through their homeowners association, are seeking to avoid their tax obligation to a metropolitan district more than 4 years after the metropolitan district was formed, more than 3 years after they first started paying taxes to that metropolitan district. The appellate here is asking the court to reverse the district court and to disregard a statute that's been part of the statutory scheme of metropolitan districts in Colorado for 65 years. You can actually trace the statute from Burns that you were referencing, Your Honor, to the current statute. I did. Not easy, but you can trace it.
The language is essentially the same.
Essentially.
One word is different.
I think they took out the word writ.
Right.
In their briefs, the appellant characterizes the statute as a simple statute of limitations. It is much more than that. It's actually a codification of a long-standing principle in Colorado that only the state can challenge the formation of a metropolitan district. Well, actually, it goes farther than that, to a municipal or quasi-municipal corporation. And the purpose for that principle is that those corporations, municipal, quasi-municipal, are entities created by statute. They become an arm of the state, and therefore the conclusion in Colorado for many years has been only the state has the right to challenge. Now, the case law supports that. Burns in particular, I think, is directly on point. It specifically holds that no private person has the right to challenge the formation of a quasi-municipal corporation. That was a metropolitan recreation district, I believe, in Burns. Very similar facts. It was being challenged by a group of taxpayers who, 3 months after it was formed, decided that the election, among other things, was not properly held. They made similar arguments to the appellant here, that there were unqualified or not properly qualified taxpayers participating in the proceedings.
Why isn't Burns distinguishable on the basis that they argue, which is that the petitioners there had notice, whereas these petitioners did not?
These petitioners did have notice, Your Honor. They had notice by publication on three different parts of the process. We got the review by the city, and the city published notice regarding the city council meeting prior to the city council meeting. The statute specifically says that constitutes constructive notice on all interested parties. The prior to the or after the petition was filed, the court, the clerk, also published the notice of the filing of the petition. So they received publication, notice by publication, twice. Then, prior to the election, there was another publication advising of the pending election regarding the formation of the Metropolitan Commission. They had three notices by publication.
That's all the statute requires.
That's all the statute requires.
What about the expert's testimony that he referred to? I can't remember his name.
Oh, the testimony regarding Mr. Dyser.
Yeah.
Mr. Dyser said that property owners were required to receive letter notice. Mm-hmm. But Mr. Dyser also said that these were not property owners. So because they were not property owners, they were not entitled to or required to receive letter notice under 3.1.204. Yeah. And I agree with you, Your Honor. There's a question whether 3.1.204 even applies here, mm-hmm. because there isn't any direct reference from 204.5.
Mm-hmm.
But even to the extent it does apply, they were not property owners and therefore not entitled to
the letter. They weren't owners of a record at the time the notice was sent.
Correct.
Okay.
I think there's one other important aspect of Burns that should be considered by Your Honors. Burns said that even in instances where a municipal, a quasi-municipal or municipal corporation has been formed, de facto, has been operating, in fact, even if there are questions about the legitimacy or legality of it, that only the state has the right to challenge that formation. And in Burns, the court found that even to the extent that that metropolitan district was not formed legally, it was, after 3 months, a de facto municipal corporation, and therefore only the state has the right to challenge the formation.
Let's assume, counsel, that somebody actually had an ownership interest in this property and was not notified, should have received notice, didn't get it, but there was publication, just like you mentioned. If the person comes in and asserts that this whole process is void because they didn't receive actual notice, your view is that they're too late if they're beyond the 30-day period and if they don't act through the Attorney General?
Yes, Your Honor, because they don't have any standing to pursue it. Moreover, they would have received constructive notice by publication.
So, but I guess my question is this. If someone asserts that, for one reason or another, they had no constructive notice of it either, that they were out of the country for a year and a half while this was all going on, they had no representative present in Colorado. Okay, as I understand your argument, you're saying that no due process contention can ever be raised after that 30-day period. Doesn't matter how egregious the due process violation is.
I don't know if I would go that far, Your Honor, but I think my reading of Burns is that even in that instance where they did not receive notice, if the Metropolitan District was formed, even if there was some legal question about its formation, the Burns Court held that if it was operating de facto, only the state, through its representative, the Attorney General, would have the right to challenge that formation.
So let me ask this question then. Is the statute subject to attack for that reason? Because it limits due process rights? I mean, we all know the Constitution takes priority over statutes. I don't understand counsel to be arguing here that the statute is unconstitutional.
We're certainly not, and I don't believe that counsel for appellant has argued at any point that the statute is unconstitutional.
Okay.
Certainly notice was not given to the Attorney General that their argument that the statute was unconstitutional.
Correct, Your Honor. Okay. Now, Burns also cites to another Supreme Court decision, Enos versus the District Court. It relies on it extensively, and I believe in quotes from it. And there's a very important quote in Enos, I believe, that is informative on this very issue. The court in Enos said that municipal corporations of the character here involved are created only upon the authority of the state by legislative enactment, and are, if created thereunder, solely for the public and not private purposes, and become an arm of the state. the right to exist as such a corporation is derived solely from the state, and any action aimed to attack its legal existence after it becomes at least a de facto corporation must be confined to the state through its official representative. I think that's exactly the situation that we have here. The appellants are arguing that there were legal deficiencies in the formation of the Marin Metropolitan District. They're now arguing, 6 years after its formation, that it should be unraveled, unwound, and Enos, the Supreme Court of Enos, cited by Burns, says, no, that can't be the case. In fact, the Enos Court goes on and says, it would be absolutely preposterous to permit the corporate existence to be called into question by a private person for the purposes of dismembering. That's what the appellants are trying to do. They're trying to dissolve this member of this metropolitan district. The court in Enos recognized that and said it would be preposterous to allow that. Counsel for the appellant argues that it should be allowed to take its arguments regarding lack of due process and from the court back to the district court for factual findings. And I don't think Your Honors need to get there. I think this statute's clear, it's unambiguous. They don't have standing, they have not pursued the action within a timely fashion. They're not the state. The state has never pursued a claim seeking to invalidate or unwind the Marin Metropolitan District. There was a reference to the Burns decision that it dealt with due process. It did not deal with due process in the same fashion that appellant is arguing due process here. Burns talked about due process in the sense of whether the 30-day limitation was too short and if that provided sufficient due process to give the Attorney General an opportunity to challenge the organization. It found that it was not too short and it required sufficient due process for that action. Here, they're arguing that individuals who received notice by publication, constructive notice, were denied due process and the ability to participate in proceeding.
What do we do with the CLS case, Judge Webb's opinion?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor.
That's why I asked it.
Yes. CLS case deals with an adoption. It's a father, natural father, who clearly had a private personal interest in his child. That father was denied due process, did not receive notice. The mother represented to the court that she did not know who the father was or where he was, and so no notice other than publication was provided to the father.
Sounds kind of like this case.
Sounds like this case. The one difference, I think very important, well actually I think there are two very important differences, facts, but on a legal note, is that it's dealing with what is clearly a private right, i.e. fathership and a right to control the adoption of your natural child. Here we're dealing with something that the Supreme Court of Colorado has repeatedly said is restricted or limited to the state. Only the state has the right to challenge. Even in instances where it's a de facto organization, only the state has the right to challenge.
Second distinction? Is there a second distinction?
The second distinction, I think, is on facts. Here, these parties clearly had notice. They had notice by publication. The other significant importance is that, and I think this is very important, Your Honors, these parties had actual notice of the existence of the Metropolitan District at the time they closed. Actually, before they closed, they received a title commitment, which had a disclosure identifying their property as being subject to the Marin Metropolitan
District. At closing.
Closing. So this would have been.
But that was after the district was formed.
Correct.
And I think, if I look at the dates, more than 30 days after the district was formed.
Correct.
So that notice would have helped them come in and challenge.
On that point, I agree. But the point that I want to make is that they had notice in May of 2008. They also started paying taxes. They received their first tax bill in January of 2009.
They waited. It was after the district was formed.
Right. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm getting my point. My point is that they waited 3 years before they challenged this.
Did they have notice before the district was formed?
Well, they had notice by publication.
No, based on the contracts?
Well, there is a contract. Their purchase agreement references the fact that a special district, it's more of a notice, a warning. There may be a special district, and I don't even know if it uses the word may, but it says you should investigate the possibility that there is a special district. That is contained in each of the condominium purchase agreements, Your Honor. So they had some notice. There's some testimony that there was notice provided by the, at least to some of the potential purchasers, by the realtors that were working for Landmark regarding the existence of the Metropolitan District. I know there was a representation that there wasn't a district at the time, but that there may be one in the future type thing. But again, the notice that the statute requires, the Title 32 requires, that each of the three phases of the approval process under Title 32 was given to these parties. They argued that they were entitled to more because they claimed that they were property owners. They were not property owners. They had a contract to purchase property in the future. There were several contingencies within that contract. They could have closed. They could have not closed. And under certain circumstances, if they elected not to close, they would have gotten their earnest money back.
Well, they were under a contract to purchase taxable property situated within the boundary of the district to be, of the area to be included in the district, correct?
Correct.
And your position is that they were not under a contract to purchase taxable property because they might not close on that contract?
No. I'm sorry my statements were confusing, Your Honor. My point is that they were not property owners. And under the statute, only property owners, even if 32.1.204 applies, only property owners that were listed with the county records as a property owner were entitled to or required to receive letter notice.
I'm sorry. I'm talking about the 30% requirement.
The 30% requirement. The 30% requirement is in 32.1.301. Yes. And it requires that at least 30% of the
tax-paying electors
sign the petition.
And the taxpaying electors are ones obligated to pay taxes under a contract to purchase taxable property.
Correct.
Were they obligated under a contract to purchase taxable property?
I submit that they were not, Your Honor.
Because
they would not have had an obligation to pay taxes unless and until they actually closed on the purchase contract.
And were they under an obligation to close?
I submit that they were not under an obligation to close.
Because?
Because there were several contingencies within the contract that allowed them to get out. First of all, the condominiums had to be completed. They had to be completed to spec. They had to be inspected and approved by the purchasers. They had to get qualified. They qualified for mortgages. There were several others. But those were contingencies in the contracts that would allow them not to close and allow them to return them.
Let me flip the question then. Why were the organizers of the district obligated under a contract?
That's a very different analysis, Robert. Okay. That's an analysis under 32.1.808 is a preclusion to qualifying electors, except in very limited circumstances. And it says that only, I think there are four exceptions, and the exception that we fall under is that if there are less than 11 registered voters within the district, then the organizer of the district has the right to qualify electors in order to have the election that's required by Title 32, and to qualify enough electors in order to elect a board of directors for that special district. Very limited clause. So those contracts were put together specifically to satisfy the requirements of 32.1.808 in order for there to be an electorate that can, so that there could be an election to form the Metropolitan District.
That's the basis for your argument that they were taxpaying electors. Strictly 32.1.808, correct?
Well, the contract also has specific language in it. The contract, the developer qualifying contracts, mm-hmm. have language in it which says that they're obligated to pay the taxes upon request by the owner.
That may be levied in excess.
Correct.
If taxes are levied in excess, they'd be obligated to pay them.
Correct.
Starting in
2008. Yeah, taxes weren't levied in excess for the district until 2009.
But your position is that this is a contract because it fits the requirements of 32.1808. Right. That depends on whether there were more than 10 eligible electors, correct? If there were,
I thought 808 said registered electors. I may be misremembering that. Because I thought there was an obligation to investigate the number of registered electors with the county clerk. And there was both a preliminary and a supplemental report indicating that there were no registered electors. And because there were no registered electors, that allowed them to proceed under 32.1808 to qualify electors so that they could have an election.
And as a bit of an aside, the trial court, to the extent we can consider its dicta, said that these were sham contracts, but the testimony was that these are standard practice.
Yeah, Russell Dykstra, who was the expert who testified, and the only expert I believe who testified at the trial court, said these are standard contracts. He practices this law. He said 89% of the new development where there is a special district utilizes this type of contract. And he said there's nothing unusual about this contract in terms of qualifying electors. In addition to that, you've got Judge Marshall, and I'm sure if you want me to talk about Judge Marshall's decision, but Judge Marshall was presented with the same issue. Landmark argued that these were sham contracts to Judge Marshall. Judge Marshall concluded that these were not sham contracts, that these were contracts that were entered into pursuant to the requirements of 32.1808.
Which, by the way, says less than 11 eligible electors. So,
okay, I apologize.
And it turns on what, if the condo owners were eligible electors, this statute would not be satisfied, correct?
If we just based on that language, I agree, but I also submit that they were not eligible electors because they were not obligated to pay taxes until after they closed, and therefore at the time of the election, they would not have had any obligation to pay taxes.
I understand your position. Council, thank you for your argument. I think you have maybe a little time left. I don't recall.
About 3 minutes.
3 minutes and 40 seconds. Good thing we have these clocks.
There are a few points I want to raise. First, the question of whether only the state can challenge the action. I want to point out that at the hearing before Judge Pratt, the issue was only time bar. It was not whether these homeowners could step into the shoes of the state. That's a different issue that was not addressed in this particular case. I will point out that in the Burns case, Burns left open the possibility that statute could be broadened to include individual challenge. If you look at the bottom of page 269, they cite the Dunbar case as an example of an individual in a private attorney general capacity raising a challenge in another case. And it just basically says that's not what we're here for. So it left open the possibility that there could be private attorney general actions. And certainly since these property owners had due process rights and property ownership rights under Denver versus Greenspoon, they would be entitled to do that. The second thing point I want to raise is whether notice by publication is sufficient. You'll notice in the CLS case that we've cited extensively that in that particular case there was notice of publication given to the filer, and the court found that was not sufficient where they should have been given the best notice possible, which in that case would be personal service or other appropriate service and actual notice of it in that case. So service by publication is not sufficient where some higher level of service is required. Third point I want to raise is regarding these contracts to purchase and Russell Dykstra's testimony. Mr. Dykstra was only generally addressing that contracts to purchase property and an obligation to pay taxes are often done. And there's no doubt about that. That's often done when there are dirt districts with less than 11 eligible electors, less than 11 individual property owners. But the facts in this case are different. The testimony of Mr. Cox was that, unlike other districts, in this case, the organizers and the attorney, Mr. Cockrell, that organized it, were told, you're never going to pay taxes. And the reason is you're never going to pay taxes, and there's a provision in there, it has to be on request. And we're never going to request you to pay taxes. Furthermore,
so what is that, an oral modification of a written contract they were supposed to credit?
No, that is a classic example of a sham contract. That is in the Luckenbach case that I cite. When there's a side agreement that we're going to put something in writing, but we're never going to enforce it, we're never going to treat the words as anything more than mere words. That's definition, Your Honor, of a sham contract, where there's a signed agreement like that. The other point I want to raise is Mr. Dykstra did not address the fact that, unlike typical contracts where there's actually a small plat that's actually recorded, in this case there never was a director's parcel recorded or platted, so there never were any tax bills on it. Since there were never any tax bills, there were no obligations to pay taxes. Your Honors, the facts of this case, if you let Judge Pratt's ruling that he had no jurisdiction stand, it opens up the door to a developer that sees the opportunity to randomly include a piece of property that will not benefit at all from a special district in order to provide tax funds to develop a completely different piece of property. And to do that without providing any notice whatsoever based on these sham contracts, that would turn the statute on its head, and that would deprive the court of its ability to consider these issues. We respectfully request that you be remanded back to the trial court for consideration of whether or not there was a due process violation and or affirmative court. Any more questions, Your Honor?
Thank you very much for your time. Thanks to both counsel for their arguments. We will issue an opinion in due course, and this case is submitted. Thank you.